welcome to this bonus edition of the Forever Bristol City podcast. It's another in the series of In Conversation With, and this time it's none other than Bobby Gould, who spoke to me this week from his home in Portishead, where he's lived pretty much the whole time since he came to Bristol City in the wake of John Galli's departure at the tail end of 1972. Bobby played almost 450 games at the highest level, scoring almost 200 goals. And that playing career started with Coventry City, went on to Arsenal, two spells with Wolves, West Brom. Then he went from West Brom to Bristol City, then to West Ham, and then over to the Gas. When he was at Bristol City, it was a relatively short stay, only 35 games long, but it was eventful to a point. And during that period, he scored 15 goals, so not a bad goals-to-game ratio there. As a manager, well, he began his career there with the Rovers. He spent two periods as manager of the Gas. Then one of his former clubs, Coventry, but it was at Wimbledon when they were in the now Premier League, where he enjoyed most success, winning the FA Cup with them in 1988. He went on to manage the Wales national team from 95 to 99. But as a manager, at club level, he managed some total of 624 games, so pretty experienced. And with all that experience and far more knowledge than any of me or my regular cohorts on Forever Bristol City have, compared with us, I began the conversation by asking him his views on the Norwich City versus Bristol City game played this week. But at my request, he did watch it on Sky. And this is what he had to say. And then after that, we go on to me talking to Bobby about his career as a player and as a manager. So I hope you enjoy it. And here we go.
Bobby, good morning to you. I made you watch football that you might not have otherwise watched. So I appreciate you doing that. Tell us what you think of Bristol City and probably the first time you've seen them on TV this season and maybe for a very long time. Give us your thoughts.
It is the first time you've seen them, but you do a lot of reading. I take the Western Daily every day. I get a little bit disappointed today. They haven't put the team in and they haven't put Norwich teams in. So I can have a moan at the Western Daily. The circumstances are that 4-4-2 system is a system that I always played throughout my managerial reign. Before that, with Jimmy Hill and Bertie Mee, I played off somebody up the middle. I just felt that the confidence that Norwich perform with was a very, very, very high standard. And their system, they would have anticipated Bristol City coming out with a 4-4-2 because they'd played on Saturday, won 2-0, and people would have been very, very, very happy. But I just feel as well that people and you and I and perhaps we don't realise, A, the amount of travelling that people have to do and play and get back on that coach. And I just wonder what time they all got home last night. Well, if it was on a plane and they
It was on a plane, it wouldn't have been too bad. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if they were driving back from there and they got away, okay, 6 o'clock kickoff, they got away at 8:30, say, they wouldn't have been home much before 1 o'clock, would they? And that's driving at speed.
And what we have to remember, Dave, is that this is it's the most difficult period in my 74 years I have ever, ever experienced. And I look at the way that football is in the Premier League on Sky Television, and it was a Sky Television last night. You know, we have the opportunity to watch it. And okay, yeah, but we can all pick holes in it.
Yeah.
We can all pick holes in it. But I've been the other side as well. I've been where Dean is.
Yes.
and you think to yourself, when you're sitting there and it's nice and quiet, and sometimes I turn the sound down and turn times, I don't have this sound. I just watch it, you know. And you do feel, I feel for people. I really feel. And yeah. Norwich, they played really well last night.
They did do well. I mean, our goalkeeper, Dan Bentley, he's widely regarded as probably one of the best goalkeepers outside of the Premier League. And I mean, his saves kept City in it in the first 20 minutes, didn't they? You know, a couple of stunning efforts to keep out goal-bound shots.
Being the father of a goalkeeper and the grandfather of a goalkeeper, he was outstanding last night. Yeah. I really did his reactions, and I think it's the confidence he's accumulated from the beginning of the season, and some of the saves were top class. They really were.
They did well.
Yeah,
the goal when it came, the first goal. I mean, Dijon was out there helping out as he does. They sort of cleared it, and I don't know whether you recall, but I saw Rowe, our wing back, fullback, whatever you want to call it, is a fullback in a 4-4-2. He just didn't run out and close the man down. But did you think there was a foul just before that ball got played out? Because I think one of their blokes knocked over somebody in the... And we almost froze for a minute because it was like they had far too much space before probably one of the shortest men on the field was able to head the ball in, didn't he?
Yeah, but the circumstances were that there were so many red shirts. If you go back, if you got the video and you played it, there were so many red shirts and the body positions, you know, I can pick holes and everything else. But, if in the team talk, you know, Hugel, he was playing, you know, he's a lad that's been all over the place, but his header was a magnificent header. And I don't think people play touch now. What I'm saying is, like, if I'm playing for Arsenal, Coventry City or Bristol City or whatever, you've got to make sure that you can get away from that defender, whether it's a split second that you come on the blind side of him. And I think that's what happened. The centre-half didn't track him. And then all of a sudden, the ball gets whipped in for the second time round, and it's a magnificent header. You have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, it was a good header, wasn't it? It was right down in the corner.
There was too many red shirts not doing a job. They were all ball watching.
Yeah.
And the circumstances are then it was very dangerous, and they paid the consequences.
Yeah. At half-time, the team went off at half-time, and if they'd have been 3-0 down, it wouldn't have been an unfair reflection, but... Even a novice like myself, in terms of a technical understanding of the game, you could see that our two wingers, which was the lad Adelaken and Palmer, they weren't offering much support for the defenders. Neither were they offering much from an attacking perspective. I mean, City mustered three shots in the whole game and none of them on target. But would you have made changes at halftime to bolster up the midfield? Because I was disappointed in Chris Martin, who's a player that you probably... No, because he's had a good career so far. But we just weren't giving the front men service, although Pham was lively. But the two wingers were leaving Nash and the inexperienced Viner quite exposed in midfield, weren't they? Where we were overrun.
Yeah, but it is a circumstances where the opposition forward defenders, they've got license to go forward. Yeah. Whereas if they can go forward, so if I'm playing wide right, and Ron Greenwood used to say to me when I in the latter stages of my career, "Gordon, we're going to play you out a little bit wider because you can see all of play and get your heels wide." I said, "What do you mean, get your heels wide, Ron?" He says, "Well, just stand on the line and you can see every part of the football pitch, you know." And this is what the modern day wide players that were playing for Bristol City, sometimes that, you know, that you if you stand still, you might get the ball. But if you're always moving, you've got to make sure the quality ball comes through. And your first touch has got to be in the top class. Now, I thought Norwich, that they stuttered for about 15 or 20 minutes into the second half.
Absolutely right. That was the one period City had where they looked like they were going to maybe get back into it, didn't they? Yeah, because that was the only time Norwich let us in, really, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it was, and in saying that, you know, when you look at the ratio of shots at goal, it's not even paltry. It's minimalistic. Mm. So, you know, I know you're playing away from home, but you've got to get the ball in the attacking third. And at Wimbledon, you know, I revert back. I hope I'm not boring people, but we had to get the ball in the attacking third ASAP.
Yeah,
we had to get it up there. And I think this is where people at this moment are trying to, they're caught between passing and they're not getting the passes. They go square.
That's right.
They don't hit that diagonal or the straight ball for a forward to get control and then bring the midfield players in.
Yeah.
Once Norwich got over that, they just overran Bristol City in the second half.
I mean, it was a practice match. I thought for the second, practice match, they were in control. They were never going to lose that game, although they only had the one goal. And that second goal, when it came 15 minutes to go, again, one of our players went down in the box, and I think he was looking for a cheap foul. He stayed on the ground. The referee let the game go, and then it was a typical striker's goal, probably the sort that you would have scored after the ball was... He drove the ball in hard. It was probably going to be an own goal off Callis's chest, but that's what a player like Hugh Gill's like, isn't it? He's right on the line to knock it in.
I think we get a little bit misunderstood with the referees and the linesmen regarding injuries like that. I think if it's a head injury, it is important that you stop the game.
Yeah.
Especially with what has been happening with people's heading of the ball, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're on the floor and you're trying to pull yourself up, then the referee and the linesman have got to keep the ball going. And the ball moves, okay, you get the cross in. It was a ricochet off somebody's body. And there's Hugh Gill again. And he's just chesting it in, really.
Yeah.
I think it's a good job that he had a Christmas pudding. Because it bounced in off his Christmas pudding.
It did. Yeah, he didn't know too much about it. But again, a goal like that, you'd have been proud of scoring that because they all count, don't they?
I'd take anything, pal. Don't you worry about that.
Now, Bristol City's record signing, they're similar money. You have Famara Diju playing up front. He scored 4 in his last 7 games. He's going to leave on a freebie in the summer because he's not signed a new contract. He seemed to be playing quite lively, a bit of a spring in his step. And do you think it's bad that the club are going to lose their record signing for nothing, apparently, in the summer? And is that him being manipulated by his agent saying, look, I'll get you better terms if you don't have to have a signing, we don't have to pay a fee for you?
Yeah, but let's be honest, how much is the agent going to get paid?
Yeah.
In my lifetime, you count all the moves I had, and the only agent I had was a lady called Mrs. Marjorie Joan Gould. And I went and I made my decisions, and Marge, she just followed me all the way around. Pickfords, they were removal people like no tomorrow. And the circumstances are that there's too many agents out there.
Yeah.
Look at Progma. Progma. It's like all of a sudden now he was useless. He weren't going anywhere. Who does his talking? His agent. Now he started to do his talking on the football pitch.
Yeah.
And it's all about that individual. It's all about being strong of mind. What am I going to do with my career? And this young man, perhaps is, you know, he wants to play well because he might impress another team. But unfortunately for Bristol City, if they lose, and we're talking like millions of pounds here,
they paid 5.5 million quid for him, and he's going to go for nothing.
When somebody's got in the back room, then somebody has got to look at the contracts that they're signing.
Yeah. Well, as we said, I think we said when we had our longer chat earlier in the week, there's a lot of players out of contract. There's going to be a lot of footballers out of contract. One player that we had that came on in the closing stages of the game, that's a name you'll be familiar with, Naki Wells, prolific goal scorer at every club he's been to. He came on and he was playing... It was like asking you to play defensive midfield almost, really, because some players, they have a particular style of playing. And when you signed a player, when you were a manager, did you sign a player to fit your system, or did you sign a player because he happened to be available at a good price? Because with Naki Wells, he's a prolific goal scorer, yeah, and he's done okay, but he just doesn't seem to feature in the manager's plans at the moment. Consistently, yep. And he would score the sort of goals that Hugh Gill got. So Hugh Gill was a name that was mentioned for us about a year or so ago, and we ended up getting Naki, and he'd scored I think 13 goals this time last year for QPR. So this time last year, he was a leading scorer for them. But, you know, when you've got a striker like that, you play to your strengths, don't you, really? You don't play him out of position.
Yeah, but with all, they're 2-0 down. They're chasing the tail. And, yeah. and therefore you've got to see 11 people. The goalkeeper's done his job, he's kept you in the game.
Yeah.
But you've got to be, okay, then how many times are you going to get the ball into the box? What are we going to do? Okay, at Wimbledon, we used to have to get 44 crosses in 90 minutes and 122 balls into the attacking third. Now, you know, you might have somebody that sat in the dugout and thinking, oh, if I get on, I want the ball there. But that's not been transmitted through to defenders saying, look, put it in the channel. So what do we mean when we put it in the channel? It's curving it. So I'm leading, I'm going to the ball, my centre-half's chasing me. Now I've got to bring it into control. Then I bring my midfield players in. And we are then advanced.
Yeah.
We're advanced. So if you look at the Norwich goals that they score, the first one comes in, goes back out again. People are not picking up players, gets a goal. And then the second one is out wide again. It's another cross.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is where Bristol City are not getting the quality of ball into the attacking third.
Yeah. No, I think if you said to any City fan who's watched us consistently, that is the fundamental problem. There isn't enough goal mouth action. Yeah, we seem to lack any real pattern of play. And, you know, it's a worrying time at the moment. I mean, we're poised right in the middle of the table, despite losing last night. We didn't move up. We didn't move down either. But the next phase of the season is going to be critical. Bob, look, we had a great session earlier this week where we talked about your career and Bristol City's part in that. Thanks for sparing the time this morning to talk us through the game last night. I won't ask you to do that again. Certainly not unless it's on Sky. Oh, you can tell me about that in a minute. But welcome to Forever Bristol City podcast. Bobby Gould, good morning to you.
Good morning, Dave. Nice to see you.
Good to see you as well. Well, look, so much to talk about here. Let's go back to your playing career right at the beginning. When did you realise that you were going to be destined for a career in football?
When Billy Thrift, the first manager of Cumbria City, when I left school at 15, so that would be 1961, and I went for a trial at Cumbria City, and after about six to 10 weeks, he said, "We don't think you're going to be good enough." He said, "I don't think you're quick enough." Oh, I says, "Oh, thank you very much." So I left. And I went and got a job in Coventry as an apprentice heating and ventilating engineer. And after that, I played local football. Billy Fifth, the manager, got the sack because Coventry City lost against King's Lynn in the FA Cup first round. And Derek Robbins of Banbury Buildings went and got a manager called Jimmy Hill.
Yeah.
Jimmy Hill looked at all the records of players that had been to the club and everything else. Anyway, so he decided to invite all the local boys back, which included me. So he said, I played in a trial on a Sunday morning. He said, "I'd like you to come back this afternoon." I says, "I'm not coming back this afternoon, Mr. Hill." He says, "Will you come back next Sunday?" I says, "Yes, Mr. Hill, I'll come back next Sunday." Anyway, I went back next Sunday, played well, scored a few goals in this practice match. And he came up, he says, "I'm going to sign you as an apprentice professional. But first of all, you have to tell me why you didn't come last week." I says, "Well, it's like this, Mr. Hill. My father, Roy Gould, is in hospital and he's losing his eyesight. He's going to go blind. And I want to see him every Sunday because that's the only opportunity." And that was what drove me on. My father going blind and knowing that his son was going to get the opportunity to play for Coventry City.
Fantastic. And that was your dad's club as well, was it? Coventry City, because that's your neck of the woods.
Yes, it was. But he wasn't allowed up by my mum. And my granddad used to take me, and my granddad, Dickie Gould, had a brother called Harry Gould, and we used to take a pigeon in a bag every game. And after every game finished, we set this pigeon off, and it went back to Uncle Harry, who had pigeons, and we'd put the score in the ring of that pigeon's foot, because he wanted the score before BBC Radio.
Yeah, and before online betting then as well, I would imagine, as well.
So that was me going to Coventry City.
That was, Coventry. Now, when you mentioned Jimmy Hill, who had an illustrious, he raised the minimum, got the revocation of the minimum wage in football, and then he went on to enjoy a career in the media. But one of his coaches there was somebody who, when we talk about your time at Bristol City, was a young, very young Alan Dix. What were your first recollections of Alan? Because he's about 10 years older than you, isn't he?
Yeah, well, the circumstances were that Jimmy Hill, had met Alan on the coaching courses, and he thought he'd be an up-and-coming young coach and everything. So he signed Alan Dix for Coventry City. I was playing like in the A team and the B team, the reserves, and Alan actually played in the reserve team. So he would see what players he'd got and how far we were going to go, what our temperament was like on the pitch and off the pitch. So Alan did a marvellous, marvellous job. And if you look back over the history of Jimmy Hill, where the amount of local lads that were successful, it was all down to Alan Dix and the coaching staff lower down.
Yeah, and I mean, you remember, looking at your time at Coventry, that very successful Coventry team that got to the first division for the first time in the club's history, I think it was, yes, and stayed for about 30-odd years. So that must have been one of your first major achievements, getting promotion, probably more than once in your time, yes, I would imagine, yes?
I would go along with that, yeah. Jimmy Hill was brilliant. He had a formidable way of managing. He'd been like chairman of the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association, and he'd learned, and his love of the game, his passion of the game. And one game we were playing against Ipswich, it was a top of the table clash on a Friday night, and he walked in the dressing room and he walked straight over to me, David, and he pointed at me and he said, you young man are going to score a hat trick. So he turned around and walked, and that's all he said. That was his team talk. He walked out and all the lads were going, it's up to you Goldie. I said, I'm the baby anyway. So after, and it was a time when Jimmy Hill had put a scoreboard behind the goal, an electric scoreboard. And after 27 minutes on this scoreboard was 9-9-9. And I just actually, within 27 minutes, scored a hat-trick.
You had scored a hat-trick in a second division game, that would have been then, about there.
Yeah.
Now, not long after that promotion that Coventry got, Alan Dix went off to Bristol City. So we come on to your time at Bristol City. But 40 goals in 82 appearances for Coventry over your time there. I'm guessing that's what attracted Arsenal to go and play for Gunners up in North London. That must have been a big move for you, because Coventry lad going away from home for the first time.
Yeah, it was some magical move, you know. And I had a history, David, of scoring goal against Arsenal. I scored against them at Highbury in the first game we'd ever played there. I scored against them at Coventry City. And Bertie Mee and Don Howe were in charge at that time, and they purchased me for £90,000.
It's a lot of money in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, but at that day, in that time, though, David, players got 5%. So I actually picked up £4,500.
A lot of money in those days.
A lot of money, David. I've got to say that. And I had a good start, but it fell away at Arsenal. I've got to say that.
Because they were building at the time their double, because they went on to do the double a year or so after you left. Why did it fall away there? Is it just the way things go?
I had about 2 years there, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. And Don Howe was in a situation of being the new coach there. And he was pressurised in the back four defenders. And I was only 21, 22, David, and I didn't have that stamina. Yeah. I didn't have that stamina at that tender age, you know, really.
And would you call that playing a high press game, like is often said now then, yeah?
Oh, very much so. It was Don Howe that first started the high press. He wanted to, because he was a defender. He was a right back when he was at West Brom, and you had to close down. And I couldn't put then. When I was at Coventry, I used to play. I never came into the defending half. And I just scored goals. I loved playing in the 18-yard box, David. That's where I scored the majority of my goals.
Yeah, got it. So Arsenal, again, good goal scoring record, but then you returned to the Midlands for spells with Wolves and West Brom, your first spell with Wolves. I mean, again, two relatively quick transfers back to back. Yes, what was that? What do you remember that time?
I wanted to be a number one. I wasn't happy. I played games in the reserve team at Arsenal. They were numerous, and there was a lot of managers coming off, looking at me and saying there was a possibility of going Ipswich here, there, and everywhere. And then Bill McGarry, he came to watch me at a game against Peter in the reserves, and it was at a time when, like these days, the players don't have long sleeves. So and when we played then, we had long sleeves. I rolled my sleeves up in reserves, and he walked out of the ground and he says, "I'm going to have him. I'm going to have that Gordy, because he rolls his sleeves up in the reserves." and when we went up for the first introduction to sign the contract, he took me out onto the pitch at Molineux, and he took me into the attacking half, and he says, "I never want to see you in our half." And I said, "Mr. McGarry, that is music. That is music to
That's
my ears."
That's what you
ears.
Wanted.
Yeah. And he got that. We had a tremendous rapport. You had David Wagstaff, Mickey Bailey, Kenny Hibbert, and Derek Dugan. I played off Derek Dugan, and Dugan used to just knock them down. And the 18-yard box was my territory. I loved it in there.
You're a poacher in the literal sense of the word. But then it was Don Howe, I think, that took you across to West Brom. So was that more that Don wanted you because you were enjoying life at Wolves by the sound of it? Was it that Don wanted you?
Yeah, but they had a fella called John Richards coming through.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah. I was going to say he was the bright up-and-coming young player at that time. So, yeah.
And Mr. McGarry says, "Look, Gordy," he says, "I'm going to sell you to West Brom because I'm going to get my money back that he paid for. We got 60 grand. And I went to Don Howe, and the first question I said, "Mr. Howe, why do you want to sign me? Because you didn't think I was very good at Arsenal." He says, "I love you in the dressing room." He says, "You're brilliant in the dressing room." I says, as a non-player. He says, no. He says, "I want you to play." He says, "Because I want somebody to play off Jeff Astle." So that was the next movement. You see, he'd watched me at Wolves. He'd seen me. He'd put my progression, and therefore we had big Jeff Astle wanted to.
And West Brom had a good team in those. Well, they were an exciting team. I'm trying to think. Was it John Osborne in goal? People like that. Clive Clark on the wing, those sorts of
Yeah, Bobby Hope,
There's many players. Was Tony Brown playing for West Brom in those days or coming through?
Yeah, that was Bomber. We called him Bomber Brown because he could get from box to box, not like me. I couldn't get from 18-yard box to the byline. But I had a short period there at Arsenal at West Brom because it was something that Don Howe went and bought another centre forward in, and then Alan Dix came for me, and I said to Marge, I said, "I'd like to go." My wife Marjorie has been fantastic. She's followed us the length and breadth, and I said, "Oh, we're off up and off," and we'd sell the house and we'd move into another house. There we are.
Yeah, and so Alan Dix came. So when because you came literally a week after he'd sold John Galli, who'd been top scorer for a number of years, John Galli. So how did Alan Dix's interest first manifest itself for you? Did he go to your manager, Don, and say, "I want to take Bobby down to Bristol"? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I think that was a situation of the manager looking at me and Don Howe. And if I was going to be in I didn't want to be a reserve team. I wanted to be in the first team. And Alan and I, we got on really, really well at Coventry, and I wanted to make sure I come to somebody that had recognised what my ability was and where I wanted to play, and that was I was the top player regarding a financial aspect of coming to Bristol City for £80,000, which is a gigantic trick.
That's a lot of money for that club, and still quite a big transfer in those days. Now, you played for City from December 72 till November 73, again, keeping up your goal-scoring record that through your career was at the very least 1-in-3, sometimes a better ratio than that. 35 appearances, 15 goals. Now, I've got a note here. When we talked last week, I say you weren't here very long. I worked with Bristol City very long, but it was eventful, to say the least. Yeah, and we talked last week about one match where you scored the equalising goal against Pompey, FA Cup third round, 1973, that was, yeah? And you remembered that because you told me something that, you know, any fan would be interested in, that you kept a record of every game that you played in, and Pompey or Fratton Park had specific memories for you, didn't it? Yes?
Yeah, as a youngster at Coventry City in the football combination, I went there, scored my first ever goal there, went there as a player for Coventry City in the first team, scored my first team goal every there at Fratton Park. And then it continued on after that, David, and I scored my first penalty ever at Fratton Park. It's incredulous. It really, really is, to have had such a record at Fratton Park.
Yeah, lucky ground for you. Now, I've got here three matches, right? This is looking through my Bristol City book. One match, it says 6th of Jan, 73, and it's a one-liner. A home game against Swindon. You scored, but in the Bristol City history, it says you also gave the team talk that day. Now, is that true or not? And that's sort of stretching the mind back a little bit.
I think somebody's stretching that a little
bit. Let's not move right. But the next one, which I can remember this, because I can remember I was sitting in the Dolman stand, and this was about 1.5 months later, home game against Brighton, right? You won 3-1, but you had a little bit of a contretemps with a certain Gerard Gow, didn't you? Yes, you got taken off after that. And if I recall correctly, you were both walking away from the penalty area up the open end, and something happened in the D. And I think it was, it's ridiculous. I can remember stuff from that time back, and I can't remember what happened 2 weeks ago, but you had a little bit of a contretemps with Mr. Gow, didn't you?
Well, yeah, Jerry was a very aggressive type of player. He wanted to win. I respected that attitude. But we clashed, yeah. We, like everybody does, you have a clash with somebody at work. We were no different. The only difference was there was like 15 or 20,000 people looking at us. And especially to say, you know, like he was a young upstart, you know, and I was trying to put him in his place. I was trying to educate him. He was a great competitor. I loved his attitude and everything else. But, you know, sometimes, you know, that communication just does break down. But we all stood up at the end of it and said, OK, well done, let's get on.
You carried on after that. And I've also got another one towards the end of your time here against one of your former clubs. Home game against West Brom, you scored, but you actually had to go in goal because Ray Cashley was injured. That must have been an experience for you.
It was, but in the latter stages of your life, as you come to analyse it, David, I then realised, and it could be a record if my grandson Matthew Gould can achieve it, because I went in goal against. In goal against West Bromwich Albion, my son Jonathan became a goalkeeper.
Yeah,
and played in the league. All we want now is Matthew Gould to play, make a league game.
And that's right. He plays for Spennymoor, I think, if I read correctly. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, he's down at I call him Matty Moo. Matty Moo's at Altrincham at the moment, you know. But it's really difficult for the non-league teams, as we see non-league. But that is the opportunity of me and Jonathan and Matthew creating a history record of three players. Who played in goal.
So it runs in the family, sort of. So your Bristol City career came to an end, and it was another highly regarded club, West Ham United. What happened there? Was it that things at Bristol weren't going as well as you would have liked, or West Ham came knocking because you were a recognised goal scorer at that time?
Yeah, there was a situation between Alan and I, and I'd grown up a little bit. I spoke what I saw about and everything else, and it just wasn't right that Alan and I were together. And the circumstances were that I sent in it's the first time ever I applied for a transfer. It was a written application, and it was after a certain incident that happened at Hull City, a lot of players at that time realised and knew what happened, and I was disappointed in the professionalism. So I said to Alan, I said, I want to leave the club and I want to go, and that was it. The circumstances were then that I was going to go on the transfer list, and that's what happened. And between Alan and myself, we've never readdressed that, because we did have one period.
It was just that one incident. And was that just a clash of style, or you use the term professionalism? I don't want to expand on that, but was it just a difference of opinion?
It's a difference of opinion, and me saying I can't accept that. I was like getting on for 28 years of age, and I'd been in a professional since I was 17, 18. I'd had 10 years, and I wanted to be in a situation where at the end of my life or end of my football career, I said, I wish I'd have done it. And that application was something that I'd only done once, and it was at Bristol City.
Yeah, got it. And the chairman back in those days was Harry Dolman. I mean, these sort of things, chairmen were much more involved on a day-to-day basis. He must have thought, what the hell's going on with, I'll call it, our record signing? Yeah, did he ever get involved in that at all, or not really?
No, not really, because it was very short and sweet, really. There was a lot. Norwich came for me, and they were in a situation of, they came for me. I travelled all the way through back to Norwich one night, got there at 1 o'clock in the morning. The manager met me at 1 o'clock in the morning, and he was in a situation of, he talked to me, and I was due to go to Norwich. The Norwich football team got beat that Saturday, and on the Sunday morning, the chairman phoned up and he said, we want you to come to Notts County. I'm sorry, Norwich. And I said, I'm not quite sure at this moment, because I want a manager that I know who's going to select me. Anyway, it all turned out that I didn't go to Norwich, and a team called West Ham United came. And once Alan Dick said West Ham are interested, I said, I'm going there.
You were there like a shot. And I guess in those days, Jeff Hurst would still have been there, wouldn't he?
No, Hurst. Hursty went. It was really in a situation of West Ham coming in, and for Bobby Gould, to be perfectly honest, David, going to West Ham was sacrilege.
I
was never a technical ball player. I was aggressive. I was competitive. I lived in the 6-yard box. I lived in the 18-yard box, and the circumstances there, you know, like me going, me, and I was told by Shankly I couldn't trap a bag of cement, and that was attitude towards me. But I went to West Ham, and
Was John Lyle manager back in those days?
No, it was Ron Greenwood. Ron Greenwood and John Lyle. John Lyle took over after about 18 months, 2 years, but Ron Greenwood was always in the background there. But if I'd have gone to West Ham, and West Ham did want me in, like before I went to Arsenal, if I'd have played for West Ham then, I would have played for England, because their type of training was phenomenal. Yeah. One touch football, two touch football, and they talk about heading the ball now and how dangerous it is. And like we always used to play at West Ham in five-a-sides or games, two touch below head
height. Below head height, which is a conventional way of playing five-a-sides and such like. So that was a good. Would you say that was a good period for you at West Ham? You enjoyed it.
I loved every minute of it.
Yeah.
The unfortunate thing in 1973, if you can remember that far back, the house market fell apart fell apart. And I was leaving here at Porter's Head. I lived in a place called River Lees, and at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, I was getting out of bed, David, and I was driving all the way up to London.
Yeah, so it wasn't sustainable. So the chance came of a move back for your second spell at Wolves, which again, although relatively short, it was quite successful. You know, 13 goals, 34 games. Were there many of your former teammates still playing there?
No. John Richards had come in too. There was Alan Sunderland. There was Steve Daly. And Stevie Kindon. There was about five of us, with Sammy Chung replacing Bill McGarry. And there was five of us before Christmas, all got double figures. We were an attacking team, you know. Yeah. And it was phenomenal. We got back promotion, but I was getting a little bit tender aged then, and I was doing a lot of travelling in the car, and I did a hamstring, and the hamstring was a long job, to be perfectly honest.
Was that a tear? A proper tear?
Yeah, it was a bad tear. But we you know, the hospitals weren't as clever as what they are these days, you know, when with the hamstrings, with the calves and everything else. So I just suffered a little bit with that situation. But it was a wonderful time to be with all those attacking players and scoring all those goals. It was quite
formidable. But all during this time, you kept your house. You were living in Porter's Head. So Bristol Rovers came knocking in 1977-78 season. Was that they knew that your career was sort of in its twilight time as a player, and that you were local, and was it Terry there as manager at the time? No, that's well before his time. Or who brought you to Bristol Rovers? How did that come about?
I was in a situation of it was Don Megson.
Don Megson, yeah. Yeah.
And Don Megson was in I went to Don and I said, look, Don, I'm playing for West Ham. I says, no, I can't do all this travelling. 4 o'clock in the morning, bang, bang, bang. He says, Gordy, come and train here. So I went and trained with Bristol Rovers.
So when you're at West Ham, you were training with Rovers.
I'd go up on a Monday, come back home on a Wednesday, and then train on a Thursday, then go up to London on a Friday and play, and then go home. So it was a lot of travelling. And during that time, I was in a situation of enjoying the training with Don Megson.
Yeah.
So when it came about that Don Megson wanted an old age centre forward, he bought me from Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Wolves. It was a logical move for you. And again, 36 games, 12 goals. Again, excellent scoring record. You finished your playing career after a short period abroad. You finished your playing career though at Hereford United. I mean, was it one game where you felt enough is enough? You know, what's it like when you know, it's a bit like Chris Brunt with City. You know, we signed him on loan from West Brom, 36 years old, and most City fans were really excited at the thought of Chris Brunt coming, but either his legs had gone or he didn't fit in. But did you get to a stage one day, or was it over time you thought enough is enough?
I've done a lot of travelling. I've done a lot of moving. I've done a lot of courses. I went on all my courses with the Football Association, the FIFA and everybody. And it came to, on one of those, I met a gentleman called Jeff Hurst. And Jeff Hurst was in a position where he was coming towards the end of his career. And we got to know each other really well. And I used to go up to him and I used to say, I'll clean your boots, Jeff, if you want. So I'm 36 years of age, you know, and I'm saying to Jeff, I'll clean your boots for you, Jeff, if you want. I said, what else do you want me to do? Do you want me to do this? I was his flat boy. I really was, because there was this great centre forward, a hat trick in the World Cup. And I was buttering up to him. There was no, you know, there we were. We had a great, great relationship. I went to Hereford with Mike Bailey. It was at Wolverhampton.
Ex-Wolverhampton, yeah, yeah.
He was the manager. I was the number two. And then all of a sudden, I went in one day at Hereford at Edgar Street, and the young lady behind reception says, oh, there's a gentleman been on the phone. She says, who is it? She said, oh, Jeff Hurst. I said, get hold of him, get him straight back. He said, so we got him. I phoned back to Jeff and he says, Gordy, he says, what's it like at Hereford? He says, I said, I've enjoyed it. He says, what about trying Chelsea as assistant manager? I says, I'm in the car and I'm coming.
So it was really a case that you were playing for Hereford, but and you were still playing, but he said, hang up your boots now and come and be my assistant. And did you play any reserve games for Chelsea or anything like that during that period in the same way that Alan Dix had done under Jimmy Hill?
I played at Ipswich once, and they were starting to play this possession football, David.
Right.
Where the goalkeeper gets the ball, he throws it to the right back passes to the centre-half passes it to the next centre-half, and the next centre-half passes it to the full-back. And I was a centre-forward, I'm going, get that bloody ball up here.
Get it
up here. And there's a lad called Brian Eastick. And we're going back now to 1981. Whether it's been good for the game or not, but I couldn't play like that these days, you know.
No.
And having three strikers, and there's three strikers, it's really difficult for them. There's no natural width. You don't have wingers, you don't have people getting... And Ron Greenwood just said to me in my latter stages, he says, Gordy, get your heels white. And if you can remember that back, they used to have these whip crosses. Harry Redknapp used to be in there, and Johnny Sissons. And at West Ham, they used to whip these balls across. But these days, there are insufficient players in insufficient positions trying to score goals.
Yeah.
And I see all the records of how many shots at goal, and they're paltry. I am in a situation where I really am disappointed with the quality of the balls that are going into the penalty area.
Yeah, no, well, we'll talk about the modern game in a moment, but we've come to, I'm just going to pause the recording here so we don't have one big file, so nothing's going to...
Yeah, okay.
Here we go. So when you were assistant manager to Jeff at Chelsea, were you still keeping your residence down in Portishead or weekly commuting?
No, what happened was that with the opportunity that Jeff Hurst was giving me, that we went to live in Camberley. My two sons were at Bristol Grammar. They went to Bristol Grammar. And they then went to a school, grammar school, in the London area. So we went lock, stock and barrel. And that's the first time ever since I'd gone to Bristol City in the early days. So it was commuting. I was the number two to Jeff Hurst. I actually had a club car, which was really nice. I'd been doing all those miles and under my own steam and everything. So we went up to Camberley in Surrey, and I was number two to Jeff, and it was just a really great learning curve, to be perfectly honest.
Great learning curve. But Jeff moved on. You took caretaker for a couple of games, but then later that year, you were then back your first managerial job as number one with the Gas, as they're known down here. Was that because you were a known quantity and you moved back down, or were you in Camberley?
It was an opportunity for us to come back. We knew the area. Bristol Rovers came in for me. I was in the situation of thinking I've learned a great deal under the jurisdiction of some great people, great managers. You have your ups, you have your downs. And it was a situation that Bristol Rovers wanted me, and I just wanted to become a manager. And that was what my...
So who did you take over from at Rovers in those days then, when you went in the first time?
Yeah, when the first time I came in, I came in, and we were still then at Eastville, and we were at the training ground as well. So it was there for me, the opportunity, and we took it, and as a family, and we came back once again to Portishead. We bought a wonderful house. My wife Marjorie says, "That's it." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "That's it." I said, "What do you mean, that's it?" She says, "We're going to call this house Evermore.
Yeah.
And we are never, ever, ever going to move again."
So, and is that where you still are now then, to this day?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, she'd done enough travelling.
So you were at Rovers. That was a bit of a come down compared to Chelsea. I would say that as a City fan, wouldn't I? But you then, I guess, when Coventry came knocking, that was too good an opportunity to turn down. Was it being your boyhood club to go back there?
It was all my love. It was all my passion. My mum and dad were still alive then, and I decided I wanted to go back. Unfortunate thing there. Once again, we our boys' education at Bristol Grammar was Jonathan and Richard was phenomenal. And Marjorie says the boys are not leaving Bristol School, so I said, well, I can commute. I can stay with mum and dad and everything else. So that was the understanding that we were remaining in Portishead, and the boys would go to their school. They'd done enough moving about, David, and we were wanted to make them more stabilised.
Yeah. But you had to, I mean, how would you rate your time at Coventry? I mean, you had, they've got here where I'm reading this, you achieved a notable 4-0 win over Liverpool. So that must have given you a lot of satisfaction when I guess Dalglish would have been in charge then, or is that before? No, that was long before his time, mid 80s. That would have been Fagan or somebody like that, wouldn't it? When
I signed Terry Gibson, I was, because of all the games that I'd attended, I'd always kept it, you know, like all my opportunities to play in there. I logged everything. And Terry Gibson. I went and paid Terry Gibson from Tottenham Hotspur, and he came in. Little Terry Gibson came in. He was brilliant. After that, everywhere I went, Terry Gibson was going, and that was my understanding with him. And I had an opportunity to select the players that I wanted to. Prior to that, David, I had to recommend players.
And
when I started, and I took a lad called Trevor Peake from Lincoln, and I took a fella called Sam Allardyce as well, and all these players that I saw on my way, and I thought if I wanted to play 4-4-2 and play that system, then they would suit it, and that's what happened. They all blended in very well.
Big Sam or what have you. So you came back, so finished with Coventry, came back to Bristol Rovers, which I guess was suited all parties, but you were off again for what is probably your most successful and renowned period with the Crazy Gang up at Wimbledon. How did that move come about?
Well, I haven't said, like, between leaving Chelsea and then going to Bristol Rovers, I actually was, I contacted Dave Bassett. I said, because we had a great relationship being with Chelsea and Wimbledon, and I knew Dave Bassett. I said, Dave, can I come and train with you? And he says, yeah, of course you can, Goldie. So I went and trained with him, and he actually said, oh, I'd like to play you in reserves. You've got a few games. So I'm 33, 34. So I started play with the Wimbledon lads. And I travelled about. I got a suntan, and the lads thought David brought me in to be like a mole in the dressing room. So I got a suntan, and they called me Morocco Mole. I never signed a contract. I just got paid on a Thursday, and that was Wimbledon. But I got to know Wimbledon and the lads and everything else. And I think Sam and Man saw me actually play in a lot of games at Wimbledon in the reserves, and Richardson Evans, the training ground. Once Dave Bassett moved to Watford, he made Sam and Man made a quick move for me.
So he came in for you because he thought, you understand the psyche of the club. We know you. We know what your values are. Dave Bassett had gone on. So Dave left. Which is a surprise, really, because they'd already got to the first division when you were there, weren't they? Yes, from that point of view.
They were in the first division, you know, and I think Sam was a handful he was an owner. He was not
Sam
just
the
a chairman.
Sam the
he
man.
Was an he was an owner, and he was going to let you know after my first game in charge at Wimbledon. He summons me to his office in London, and he kept me for 2 hours outside. And I'm the manager, and I'm thinking I should be training. And he said, when I went in to see Sam O'Malley, he sat his programme at me, and I picked it up. He said, read that programme. He said, read page 3. So I was reading, that was my programme notes. And he said, yeah. I said, oh, and my team will do that. And he'd underlined my team. He says, for all your stay here, you will never, ever, ever say it is your team. It is my team, and I'm paying all the money.
But so that FA Cup run, when you took them there, 1988, I mean, sometimes they say with the FA Cup, you know the cup's got your name on it. Yeah, well, did you ever feel that? And then you must have gone for that match against Liverpool with a lot of trepidation. Were you so much the underdogs that you had nothing to lose, so you just played in that way, in that mindset?
No. Well, when I was at Wimbledon, Dave Bassett took all the staff with him. So I was left without any staff. So there was a gentleman called Don Howe, just been sacked by England. And it was like asking Miss World to dance, you know? So I phoned up Don. I said, Don, would you like to come and join me at Wimbledon? He said, Gordy, he said, I'll come and I'll have 4 weeks with you, and I'll see whether I like it. So he came and joined us, and it was Don's time of not being pressurised, of being a manager, but just a coach. And he was a fantastic, fantastic coach. And the lads loved him. You know, there's Don Howe, there's Wimbledon kicking the long ball, and he mastered it. He knew what everything was, you know, we were going to do. And that was the opportunity for him to step back and Don do the coaching. And we had a wonderful relationship.
So although you could argue with Don Howe that, well, he was a very sophisticated coach, and he was an advocate of the high press, he was able to finesse what Wimbledon were doing with their long ball style. He was just able to make that style work even better. Is that what you're saying? If I interpret.
But not only that. Like, so we have a wonderful run in the FA Cup, and we get to the final. 48 hours before the final, we pick the team, and he comes in on the Friday morning. He says, Gordy, he says, we haven't got it right. I said, what do you mean we haven't got it right? He says, well, they've got John Barnes at Liverpool, and he's playing out of his skin, and we've got Alan Cork in that wide right position. He says, what we're going to do is going to change Alan Cork to wide left and Dennis Wise to wide right. And every time Liverpool look up, all they'll say is John Barnes squeezed between Dennis Wise and Clive Goodyear, and they couldn't get the ball to him.
Yeah,
and nobody's ever picked it up, really. And he and John Barnes didn't have the ball that he was getting every Saturday prior to that, you know. And that was one of the advantages. And Dennis Wise that year, 84% of our goals were scored by dead ball free kicks, and we worked and worked at them, David, and that's what did us. You know, we stuck to this regime, and it was only come to breathe on the Friday. But that was my relationship with Don, and the lads understanding it, and we achieved what nobody said we were going to ever do.
You had some characters in that side, didn't you? You mentioned one, Dennis Wise, but I guess at that time there was a certain Vinnie Jones playing. What was he like as a character?
But Vinny, I took a personal interest in Vincent's life. I always call him, Vincent, and his upper stages of his life when he was at home with his mother and father, and you know that I don't think there were good days for him and his sister, and it's something that I got into because I wanted to know what it was all about, and how can you handle somebody like Vincent Jones and John Fashanu?
I was going to say John Fashanu, yeah.
And Laurie Sanchez, Dave Bassett, Besson.
Dave Besson, yeah.
Yeah, and you had all these players, and they were moulding, and you had to give them the respect that they earned and everything, and it worked well for us, to be perfectly honest, David.
Yeah, and Vinnie Jones, he was a much softer character than he would create the impression of, would you say? Away from the pitch?
Yeah, but the circumstances are that somewhere along the line, you have to understand what is your strength, what are my strengths. If you've got a personality, what are you going to do? But if you're in a bad situation, how are you going to get out of that bad situation? And that's what we try to help all the lads. And the team that actually won the FA Cup, and we're going back to 1988, David, and Sam and Man, and we sold that team for £13 million in 1988. And, you know, OK, we brought them through. They got the opportunity in life. And you know, Sam saw the money and we took the money. But we rebuilt again. I signed Keith Curl. I signed Terry Phelan. And this is something, you know, throughout your career, this is what you achieved. And this is what you did with it.
Was Keith Curl, because obviously Keith Curl was at Rovers as a very young player then. City took him, and was it you that took Keith Curl? Did he go from City to Wimbledon, or was it City to Man City?
No, he went to Reading.
Right.
Terry Cooper first started with him, and Terry Cooper, because when I was at Bristol Rovers, they used to have a rose bed at the back of each goal.
They did, yes, they did.
Yeah, and, well, every cross that Keith Curl put in as an outside right, a number seven, it always ended up in the rose bowl. So what but he had tremendous pace, David. Keith Curl had tremendous pace. And what Terry Cooper did was he converted him to a fullback and then into a centre half. When I paid a lot of money for Keith Curl because he got pace. And at that time of football in this country, it was all about pace. Yeah. I had Roger Joseph, I had Keith Curl. And Terry Phelan and John Scales. Do you know what?
John Scales, ex-Bristol Rovers, wasn't he? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they were the fastest back four in Europe.
Yeah.
They could run.
Yeah.
And we utilised that as well. So, you know, when you look back over the history of what players actually achieved and where they came from, it was going from rose beds to being a manager now.
Yeah, I always said with Keith Curl that what he lacked as a defender in the sense of, you know, because he was converted in the early stages of his career, he could make up for with pace, couldn't he? Because, you know, a defender can be better positioned and not have the pace, whereas Keith, you know, he had that pace to get him out of trouble, I guess, when he's...
But also, as you get a little bit older, your football knowledge becomes a little bit different, you know, and it's something that you tune yourself into, and all the courses that you go on, your education, the things you've done right, the things you've done wrong and everything else, and you have to analyse them.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm sat up in my little office, and if I was to go through all, I'll just showing you that now, this is all going round, this is my office, okay? And what I'm trying to do down through lockdown, I've got to tidy this all up. And it all goes back. It all goes back to 1958.
That's a long history, a long illustrious history. Show us that book where you recorded every single match. You were showing me that earlier. Just tilt the phone down on there, because that shows dedication, that does. Every single game you played.
So this is 1962-63. And these are all the games I played. I played for Coventry City Reserves, Coventry City A, Coventry City B, Coventry City Youth, Birmingham County. I got 44 goals in 41 games.
That's very impressive. Very, very impressive.
And then this is where I make my first team debut at 17 at Gay Meadow. And 13,619, I drew 0-0.
Amazing stuff. Let's go back to your transition from club manager into international management, because after Wimbledon, you went back to West Brom, a club that you'd played for, and you had good success there. Again, with Don Howe, you went back to Coventry, and you had Mick Quinn, I think, playing for you there as well. So good periods there. When your club management career came to an end, was it because, you know, is it all about the relationship with the chairman, or you were becoming a little bit disillusioned with club football? What happened prior to joining the Welsh national team? You know, was it enough for enough, or it was a natural transition to be an international manager?
No. I was on Sky. I went and worked for Sky Television, and in my own way, I could be my own self. And after Andy Gray and Richard Keys on a Monday night, I had a slot there from about 10 o'clock talking about the game that had been previously played. So in my latter stages, I was more in television and everything else and more on Sky. And I enjoyed it. I had a laugh with Richard Keys and Andy Gray. We had some giggles. We still giggle, the three of us now, you know.
Yeah.
But the opportunity came from Wales to... I was in the West Indies and somebody, my best mate, phoned me up. He says, Gordy, he says, the Wales job's up for grabs. He says, do you want it? Like a lad called Bill Smith. I says, Bill, I says, I'm on the beach. The sun's shining. It's 75 degrees. And you're asking me if I want a Welsh job. Anyway, so I thought about it. I put an application in. And then I was interviewed over in Cardiff. I accepted the job. But being the period that I went through, I was not knowledgeable of being an international footballer.
That's interesting, because that was going to be my next question. What's the big difference between being a club manager and an international manager? The obvious one is there isn't a match every week, but where do you feel that, you know, it didn't work for you, or it's different?
I was naive because I'd never played international football. It's one of my... It was a decision. I look back now and I should have said no, to be perfectly honest. I lived just across the water. I didn't take long to get to work, but you weren't with the players day in, day out. And that brought the best out of me, you know. And I tried to bring people in, but to help me, but I was not of international playing knowledge. And therefore, it was the worst decision I ever made, to be perfectly honest. I apologise to the Welsh FA. I apologise to the Welsh supporters, to the players. And I was not right for that position.
Yeah, you weren't. Okay, but, you know, it was a fair length of time. But, you know, and you had some interesting players to deal with, didn't you? Mark Hughes, Robbie Savage, John Hartson, but... I guess, had you had John Hartson at Wimbledon, or was that well after he'd finished there?
No, he was in and around, and we were in a situation when we was at Wimbledon, we used to have Dave Bassett started. Like if there's any ever problems, the two players or the management, or there was a circle formed, and there was a situation where there's a wrestle and tumbling to get rid of the anger. Well, I attempted that with John Hartson.
Yeah,
when I was at Wales, I was at Newport, and you've got all the players. You've got Mark Hughes, you've got Ryan Giggs, you've got Gary Speed, you've got all these great international players, and they said, you're not taking him on. I said, yes, I am. I said, he's got to get it out of his system.
He's a bit bigger than you, though, isn't he?
Yeah, so on my back, so was my scratches on my back as well. But, you know, that was part of my education, part of learning. But if you're ever going to become a manager, anybody out there, make sure that you cover the range that you're managing, and that is international football. And it was something of a learning curve that
That's interesting. Came. So since then, you've become more of a media person, really, haven't you? I mean, what do you do to... you know, to pass your day now, yeah? Because we've talked earlier, we talked a couple of weeks ago about you're able to watch football, you know, all day on a Sunday, yeah? Are you, you know, is football still your main occupation, or do you just like to relax and turn your back on it a little bit? You must miss it, surely.
It's a four-letter word. It's love. It's the love of the game. I was given an opportunity. Some people said I wasn't good enough. It's been a challenge. I've enjoyed that challenge. I've enjoyed seeing my two sons grow up and be successful. And I hope that with Marge, my wife, we've been married nearly 53 years now. We got married when we were 20-odd. And to see my two sons grow up in, they've got great, great positions that they're in. Richard's a CEO of Surrey Cricket Club. Jonathan was an international footballer. And that's the love and the passion that this has given me. And if somebody had said to me when I left Caledon Castle School in Coventry in 1961, you're going to achieve this, you know, you're dreaming, pal.
You enjoyed every minute. I mean, playing 440 games, 160 goals. That's better than one.
No. Can we just identify that? It's 189 goals.
Right? 189 in all competitions. Sorry. Don't believe on what you see on Wikipedia. Then, from that point of view. All right. That's been good. I'm just going to pause for a moment. Just bear. Here we go. So, Bob, like you, not been to a live match for nearly a year, but there's plenty of football on television. One of the things that I've noticed is that referees, you don't notice them so much on the televised matches. Is that because they're under less pressure from the crowd? Is that something that you've noticed as a professional, that the referees aren't quite so controversial, apparently?
That's an interesting thought, David. I haven't thought of that, you know, because they look more relaxed. But the only difficult thing is what's happening like 100 miles away, or 120 miles away, 150 miles away. Somebody's adjudicating what their decision is.
Yeah. And, well, that's true, because that was going to be another thing about referees, because VAR is obviously just in the Premier League. And I don't know whether you've watched stuff. If it's Premier League only that you're watching, then you're absolutely right, because the decision has gone away from them. But lower level stuff, I mean, I've noticed it watching City, but it's just not quite so. You don't come away from a game saying, oh God, wasn't the referee rubbish? You know, but so talking about VAR, that's a big thing at Premier League, the effect it's made there, because you don't know if the goal's been allowed, do you? You can't celebrate.
No, you can't celebrate. But circumstances are there, because it's going to be a time that it's going to go back, you know, to stock leagues where it's all being authorised. I would be more interested if a player was to attend stock league and be in that area. They've got referees. Why don't they have a player's opinion and everything else, and where the ball's bouncing? Does it hit his hand? Is his hand moving and everything else? I just feel at times that, you know, that they've taken that strength away from the referee. And talking about, you know, if you're refereeing and you've got 45,000, 50,000, 60,000 people watching you, just imagine, you know, Manchester United against Liverpool last weekend, and the pressure that you're under and what you've got to make. You've got to make those decisions.
But didn't you think, I mean, I watched a bit of Man United Liverpool last week, and it wasn't the greatest game to watch. But we know, and I didn't have the crowd effects noise on for some reason, but that it was almost like a practice match. The intensity isn't there for some of them, is it? Would you agree with that view?
Yeah, I go along with that. You know, but I've got to say, what you've got to remember as well, David, is the games, the way they are coming now, as a manager, you would find it really, really difficult to get the momentum going. And we're not just talking 16 to 18 players. We're talking to players that are perhaps in the reserve team. What are they doing? What about the youth team? Mm. What about the backroom staff now? I can't believe the volume of backroom staff that stand in the dugout. And as soon as, if I'm a player and I've got somebody telling me I'm going to go on with 2 minutes, and this person is saying, oh, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, I'd be saying to that person with all the notes of it, this is my chance, leave me alone. Mm. And instead of going in there and trying to get into somebody's brain, I mean, I've got 2 minutes.
I know.
Let, And to me, I think they've got to review situations. When I went into football management, I phoned up Brian Clough. It took me 85 calls. It took me 88 calls for my secretary at Bristol Rovers to get hold of Brian Clough. And I got hold of Brian Clough after 88 calls. She came running down the corridor. She says, "I've got him." I said, "Brian, Bobby Gould here. I'm just a young manager." I says, "What advice would you make?" And the line went dead, David. And all of a sudden he said, "First thing I do, young man, is call me Mr. Clough." And the second thing, young man, make sure you get your backroom staff right. And the phone went down. It took me 8 years to get the backroom staff and what I wanted to do. And that's when we won the FA Cup. And I'm saying to people now, you cannot control 16 players or 18 players in the first team, 16 or 18 in the reserve, the youth team, and then you've got all these people trying to interpretate what the team are playing a week ago.
You see them on the touchline just before a player goes out. They've got an iPad there and they're doing all this pointing as to how you should play, and it just... No, it's madness. It is madness.
It is. Okay, they listen to this or they see this interview. They're going to say, "What's he on about?" I'm telling you that I've been in that dugout. I know that if I want my number two, my number two is Phil Neal or Donohoe, I just say, "You're in charge." I can't see. I've got a mist come down in front of me. And that's what happens when you're a manager sometimes with the pressure. Klopp at the moment has created a horrible problem for himself with penalties and everything else. We never get penalties. Never say anything like that because everybody will imply then you're trying to get penalties off referees. And somewhere along the line, people have got to say, "I am the manager.
Yeah.
I run this. I run this team." They don't run the club, but they run the team.
But that's an interesting point you've raised there, that I am the manager, because you talk, not you, but in football, you talk about these directors of football that go out and select players and play the market. Did you ever have a chairman tell you to buy or select a player in your career? And if he had done, I would imagine I'd know what you'd say to him.
Two-letter word, no.
No.
If I was going to buy a player, he had to come up to my standards.
Yeah.
I had a chief scout. Now, he would go and I'd say, go and watch him. I want a written report. I want this. And then if it's anything, you and I drive and we'll go and watch him together.
Yeah.
And that is the art. If you look back, I took Graham Withy from Bristol. You look at the players I took back, Nicky Plattenhauer. I took them with me because I believed in them and they had the ability and it was an opportunity for them. And that is what I see, not what you see, David. It's what I see.
Yeah.
And that's the problem today, I think, with purchasing and players. And another thing is I cannot tolerate the amount of foreign players that are coming into this country.
You've preempted, because I was going to ask you about that, because even when you were a club manager 25 years ago, the percentage of foreign players would probably be less than 15%. Now in the Premier League, it's probably 70% in the Premier League, I would say. And, what's your view of football agents? Because you have all these scouting networks in Europe with all the statistics, and you've got your little... If you look at most foreign players, they've got a little video clip on YouTube and you can see all the wonderful things that they've done. Do you think agents serve a purpose, and would you have ever selected a player? Would you want to be a manager now? That's the key thing, because that's...
Yeah, but it all depends upon your standards. If you've got a player that's on £350,000 a week, £350,000 a week, and he is not playing, what is going wrong? What has happened to Arsenal Football Club? One of the strictest disciplined football clubs with finances that you'd ever wish to meet. But it's now at this moment, it's the directors of football. You've got a great job, pal, without pressure.
Yeah, because the butt doesn't stop at you, does it, from that point of view? What's your view? Talking about managers around today, I mean, and you may have come across him as a player and in his early managerial days, Neil Warnock. He does a job, doesn't he? Would you say he is old school? And you can't knock his track record, can you?
No. Well, Neil was a physiotherapist when he first started his career. Yeah. And that's where he's come through the ranks that way. You know, it's the same as Don Howe. Don Howe was he wasn't managerial because he didn't enjoy that. You know, I enjoyed being a manager. I was a better manager than I was coach, and Don Howe was a better coach than he was manager. And you know, we all throughout the history of our period, you know, because we, you know, like in like 10 years' time, there'll be a different era out there. It'll be another design of a football club. Our football club is run. Yeah. You know, we used to have individuals. Derek Robbins that owned Coventry City. You know, how many people own a football club now? The amount of foreigners that are coming in to run Premier League teams, and how much are they paying? It is phenomenal. It is really phenomenal. But comes everything. It's a little bag of wind, David, that you blow up. And you put a case around it, and you try and put the ball into the back of the net.
And that's all it's about at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yes.
A couple of things just to finish up with. One that you'll know, one of the leading, or his family, Jeff Assel's family, and dementia in football linked to heading the ball. And it's in rugby now. I think a couple of players have sort of jumped on that. Heading the ball in football, is that something that, you know, 50 years ago, the balls were, I was going to say, like that?
Well, do you know what this ball is?
Go on.
It's my hat-trick ball for Wolverhampton Wanderers against Manchester United.
And I bet that weighed a ton on a wet day in February.
That's your knowledge of experience. This is a leather football, a real leather football. And it, my two sons at the time, they battered this ball. They battered it backwards and forwards in the, and what it does, it absorbs football. This football absorbs water, and inside it, and it does, David. It gets heavier and heavier. The new lighter ball is different. It's plastic.
Yeah.
And That's what is, and it is dangerous, because the amount of times that I saw a fella called George Curtis for Coventry City
centre half, yeah,
and they used to practice heading the ball. I always lived off Derek Dugan or Jeff Astle for knocking balls down. I sometimes did score headers, but they weren't like in the air, and they were little knockings. Hopefully, I haven't got the dreaded disease that have affected.
Well, you seem pretty coherent now, so I'd say you're all right, actually. A final question. I mean, look, we've all been locked up, not seeing live football. Post-COVID, I sincerely hope, we'll be back in the ground by August. I think that's something that we could look forward to. Do you think that's true, and or do you think that's a bit being a bit optimistic on my part?
I think you might be optimistic. My wife and I, I'm 75 in June. Marge has just become 74. We just have, you know, we've been living in New Zealand for. My wife has not had a winter in UK for 14 years. She's always out to New Zealand. We have 4 or 5 months in New Zealand. We're very lucky. We come home. I just feel that we have to take each day as it comes, David. And unfortunately, I don't think people are really evaluating what is happening. What is happening? We have to tread carefully. And some of the news programs that we see, the horrible situations of losing loved ones and everything else. I don't want to be a preacher, but I'm just saying, do the right thing.
Yes.
And if we do the right thing, then, you know, we'll learn to understand something somewhere along the line. And at the same time, you know, with football, it'll be recharged. And will it come next August? David, just wait and see. Don't wish every day away, but just make sure.
Do you think with finances and what have you, that if one club goes, it'll be half a dozen or more might go? Because, you know, outside of the Premier League, where big transfers are still taking place, it's a quiet window this year, but they haven't got the off-field income. I mean, how are a club like Bristol Rovers surviving, even, or even a Cheltenham Town, you know, because they've got zero income, haven't they?
Yeah, but yeah, all of a sudden, though, but Cheltenham Town get a Manchester City.
You
get a Manchester City, then the finances will be, you know, or won't be so heavy and everything else. David, I just hope and sincerely hope that everybody can get together and maintain the input of what we have understood and what has given the Gould family a wonderful, wonderful life. You know, we've never come across what we're suffering at the moment. But I just wish that, you know, we can all not try and do things that we shouldn't be doing. We know in our own mind we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, no, very true. True words indeed. Bobby Gould, it's been great talking to you. We could have talked about so many things with your record of your playing career. You know, that's incredible that you've kept all of that. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for joining us.